Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Go no farther. There's nothing in this cave worth dying for. Those were the words printed on the sign at the entrance of an underwater cave in Vortex Spring, a favorite spot among divers in Florida. Despite this plaintive warning and the drawing of the Grim Reaper that accompanied it, many divers of differing skill levels failed to heed these words in search of adventure. On August 18, 2010, 30-year-old Ben McDaniel was seen entering the water in his scuba gear. He was never seen on land again. What was at first assumed to be a tragic yet straightforward diving accident came into question as days went by without Ben's body being found. Did Ben get deeper into the cave than anyone could have imagined? Or did someone remove him from the water before searchers could find him? Some have questioned if Ben was ever in the water at all that night, or if something completely different happened on the ground. The only thing we know for sure is that after a decade, despite an extensive search and a hefty reward, no one knows for sure what happened to Ben McDaniel. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Ben McDaniel. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we are the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about this case going into the episode, and he is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones that you have at home. Before we get started today, I want to thank Taffany M., who's joined us over on Patreon. Thank you, Taffany, so much for your support.
Thank you.
As a reminder, you can get episodes early and ad-free at any level on our Patreon. You can also get ad-free episodes by subscribing to us on Apple Podcasts. So now let's get into the case of Ben McDaniel. Benjamin Wayne McDaniel was born on April 15, 1980 to Shelby and Patty McDaniel in Collierville, Tennessee, outside of Memphis. Ben was the oldest of three boys. He had two younger brothers, Tim and Paul. He also had a half-brother, Brad. Now, the McDaniel family was wealthy, but while money certainly helps with a lot of things, it doesn't protect you from tragedy. In 2008, Ben's younger brother, Paul, died of what was believed at the time to have been a stroke. He was only 22.
When you say believed at the time, what does that mean?
Well, so it was believed at the time to have been either like a stroke or a heart attack. He was unconscious and was taken to the hospital. It was later found that it was basically related to an opioid overdose.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah. But the family didn't find that out until much later. Obviously, the entire family was just devastated in general because Paul was only 22. And so along with his brother, Tim, Ben started the Paul McDaniel Foundation to raise awareness about strokes and organ donation.
Good for them. Mm-hmm.
Ben was always an outdoorsy guy, and Paul had been his frequent rock climbing buddy. He attended the University of Memphis, but didn't choose a major that would have kept him indoors and chained to a desk. Instead, he decided on construction management. His free spirit in nature led him to opening his own construction business after his 2004 graduation. Ben got married, and things seemed to be moving along nicely for him. But then, of course, came the 2008 death of Paul. Ben was the one who found his little brother unresponsive in his home.
That's really tough.
Yeah. So he found him, obviously had no idea what was going on. He tried to clear his airway and perform CPR, and he called 911 when his efforts failed to revive Paul. Paul was rushed to the hospital, but again, didn't make it. Ben, as you can imagine, was plunged into grief. And it seems as though after this, things really started to go downhill for him. Paul's obituary mentions his survivors, of course, including Ben and his wife, Sarah. I don't have the exact timeline for any of this, but at some point shortly thereafter, he and Sarah split up. Mm. Now, coincidentally, 2008, the year of Paul's death, was also the year of the huge U.S. housing market crash.
Right.
And that, combined with a bad business partner, caused his construction business to fail. So he had to declare bankruptcy, and Ben also ended up losing his house. He also ended up with a reported $50,000 tax debt to both the state of Tennessee and to the IRS.
Was that like through his business?
I think so. It might have been a combination of both, but yeah, 50 grand. By 2010, Ben McDaniel's life had basically fallen apart.
Yeah, definitely not in a good spot.
No. He basically, as you can imagine, fell into a pretty deep depression, you know? I mean, with everything just piling on top of each other. And it had to have been difficult for Ben's parents, who are still grieving over Paul's death, to see their other son struggling so much. So they suggested that he get out of Tennessee and basically take a sabbatical. The family had a beach house in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida, and they offered it to Ben. They'd pay his expenses while he took a year off and worked on healing.
Jeez, that's nice.
I know, right? Ben smartly jumped at the idea. And along with his chocolate lab Spooner, he moved down there in April 2010. Around this time, he also reconnected with an old girlfriend, Emily Greer, who worked as a wetlands biologist. The move to the beach also allowed Ben to rediscover one of his long-held passions, scuba diving. Ben had begun diving when he was 14, taking his tanks into the family pool in Tennessee. He eventually became a certified open water diver, and once he moved to Florida, discovered nearby Vortex Springs. Though Ben lived on the beach, he preferred freshwater diving, and Vortex Springs provided the perfect opportunity as it was located inland just north of Ponce de Leon. Ben soon became a fixture at the springs and on online scuba diving forums. In person, he was hard to miss at 6'1" and 210 pounds. Employees and fellow divers would often see him in the water or on the banks jotting notes in his diving log. Ben had all the right equipment and seemed to know what he was doing. All divers are required to have an open water certification, which Ben had. However, one employee, Chuck Cronin, said that Ben was often overconfident in his diving abilities. For instance, though diving buddy is recommended for safety reasons, Ben often dove alone. But Ben didn't just ignore safety advice. He also broke some pretty serious rules. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire, and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, like, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. We sleep better when we sleep cool. As the weather is getting warmer, staying cool while we sleep will be top of mind. Organic and natural bedding sleeps cooler than cheaper synthetic alternatives, and they last longer too. A fresh season calls for a fresh start, and that includes your bed. From seriously soft organic cotton sheets to breathable silk and luxurious down duvets, Avocado Green's bedding makes it easy to reset your space sustainably. Perfect for hot sleepers in warmer months, Avocado Green sheets and duvet inserts are naturally breathable and help regulate temperature, so you sleep cool, dry, and comfortable all night long. Avocado bedding is thoughtfully designed and expertly crafted for lasting durability. From reinforced stitching to premium long staple organic fibers, every detail is made to stand the test of time, wash after wash, season after season. We sleep better when we sleep cool, so head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better. Vortex Springs bills itself as the largest diving center in the state, and divers love it because of its clear water that is fed from the Floridan aquifer. There's a cavern full of wildlife at 58 feet deep, which is also a big draw. But the more daring and experienced divers love it for something else. Its cave. The cave at Vortex Springs is 300 feet from the cavern and 115 feet or 35 meters down. At the entrance is the Grim Reaper sign I mentioned in the intro, the one that says, "Go no farther, there's nothing in this cave worth dying for." Despite this, many divers do, in fact, decide to venture in. But here's what's important to note. Doing so requires an additional certification. In addition to the open water certification, there's also a cave diving certification, which requires 125 hours of additional training. Ben was only certified to dive up to depths of 30 meters, so he could go to the cavern, which was 18 meters down, but he wasn't even supposed to go to the entrance of that cave because it was too deep. The reason diving deeper than 30 meters requires a separate certification is because it requires a special combination of breathing gases in your tanks to keep you from getting decompression sickness, aka the bends,
right,
or nitrogen narcosis.
Oh, that sounds ominous.
Yeah, that's what I thought too, right? And also, like, narcosis made me think of necrosis. And I was like, what is it doing to you? Like, it sounds really scary.
Yeah.
It's not necrosis. Narcosis is an intoxicating effect that causes dizziness, lightheadedness, elation, euphoria, and anxiety, all potentially causing the diver to make poor decisions and mistakes. In severe cases, narcosis can cause debilitating inertia, blindness, unconsciousness, and death.
Yikes.
Yeah, right?
That's some pretty serious symptoms there.
Yeah, and definitely not anything you'd want to experience when you're like 35 meters down in a flipping cave. I want to take a moment right here too and pause to say that I know absolutely nothing about scuba diving because it does not and never has sounded remotely appealing to me.
Same.
Like, I am claustrophobic. I am scared of the water. I mean, I'm not scared of the water. Like, I go swimming and shit, but I'm scared of what's down there. Like, I don't want to, it is none of my business. I feel like the ocean, like, what is beyond what I can see with my two eyes, like, just like looking in, none of my business. Don't need to know.
Yeah. No.
Not put there for me.
I watched The Abyss when I was a kid and, like, great movie, probably doesn't hold up. I have no idea, but it terrified me of scuba diving.
Yeah, listen, I don't know, but I saw James Cameron go down and look at the Titanic, and that was enough for me. Like, it's just, it's none of my business. However, luckily for this story, there's a Reddit user by the name of Misadventure Mystery, who is apparently a diver, and they did an extensive write-up on Ben's case that included a lot of this technical information. Like, I had no idea that there are multiple certifications and multiple depths and, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? So anything in here that makes it sound as though I know the first thing about diving is mainly because of this person. The Reddit posts, of course, are listed in our sources on the blog. I highly recommend that you read them for yourselves if you're interested in this and, you know, getting a deeper dive. Pun absolutely intended. I was so proud of that. All right. Anyway, all of this is to say that Ben was a decent diver with many years of experience, but he was not extensively trained. Despite this lack of training, many people believe that Ben routinely visited the cave at Vortex Springs, and he was seen in the vicinity of the cave by other divers. Ben's girlfriend, Emily, lived in Tennessee, so in early to mid-August, he returned there for about a week to visit her and his parents. Ben was in great spirits on that trip, and he told Emily that he was looking forward to getting certified as a diving instructor. He also said that he had been researching cave diving with the idea of getting certified in that as well. Ever the entrepreneur, Ben's eventual plan was to open his own diving business. Before leaving Tennessee on August 15th, Ben wrote his parents a note thanking them for helping him through his difficult time. He also promised to return the favor and take care of them in their old age. On August 18th, Ben was back home in Florida and back at Vortex Springs. He did a dive that afternoon, and other divers later reported seeing him near the cave looking around, almost as if he was investigating. After this dive, security footage shows Ben at the dive shop filling his tanks. We don't, however, know what he was filling the tanks with. And this obviously becomes important later. He spent the rest of the afternoon hanging around, testing equipment, and writing in his dive log. It definitely seemed to witnesses that he was gearing up for something.
Like going into the cave for the first time?
Well, no, not necessarily for the first time, but yeah, because, you know, witnesses had already seen him poking around, right?
So maybe diving deeper into
the cave. Yeah, yeah, like... But it did. It seemed like he was kind of investigating, getting the lay of the land, so to speak. And was just making a plan. And it turns out that Ben was gearing up for another dive. At 7:30 that evening, Ben went back in. Now, by this time, the dive shop was closed. Two employees, Chuck Cronin, who I mentioned earlier, and Eduardo Terran, often went on dives after closing up the shop. In fact, like, they had a tradition of going on Wednesday evening dives specifically, and August 18th was a Wednesday. So they went on their dive, you know, I don't know what time, but earlier. And so by the time Ben was coming in at 7:30, they were basically coming back up. So they saw him with his lighted helmet heading in. Now, even though they knew Ben wasn't certified for cave diving, it was pretty well known that he was going down there anyway. Technically, anyone who dives down deep enough can go into the cave, but as it narrows and gets more dangerous, there's actually a locked metal gate that is basically there to keep inexperienced divers from venturing into a spot that they can't get out of.
This all sounds terrifying.
Right? Like, a sign with a, like, I'm sorry, if I'm anywhere and I see a sign with a Grim Reaper and it's like an old pirate sign that is like, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Like,
yeah,
I'm out.
No,
I'm so far out.
No chance. And like a metal gate underwater. Mm-mm.
No. And so check this. So in order to access this metal gate, basically, you go up to the dive shop, you show the employees, you know, your cave diving certification, and they'll give you the key. And then you take the key underwater and unlock the gate.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
Like, it is
nope.
So scary to me, just even reading about this. Now, this gate, however, is not insanely secure. I mean, it's mainly supposed to be a deterrent, you know? Mm-hmm. So if somebody is like kind of brave, like they don't just accidentally find themselves again in a tight space that they physically can't get out of.
Right.
Now, apparently Chuck and Eduardo had suspected that Ben was forcing his way past the gate. So that night, Terran actually dove down and opened it for him. The idea behind this was that if he was going to go down there anyway, they could at least make it slightly more safe by removing this obstacle.
Hmm. Okay.
I don't know about all that, but that's apparently the reasoning. Evening dives were a common practice for Ben, and oftentimes Chuck and or Eduardo would kind of hang back until they saw the bubbles that indicated Ben was coming back to the surface. On this night, however, the pair left while Ben was still down there. The next day, Thursday, was a busy day at Vortex Springs. It's the dead of summer in Florida, which is not very pleasant climate-wise for anybody who's been there. Florida in August is not something that people typically write home about. And Vortex Springs isn't just a place for diving. They actually have like water slides and a picnic area. It's kind of like a whole park situation. So it attracts a lot of families. Basically, they just had people in and out all day, and nobody apparently noticed that Ben's truck was still in the parking lot. The next morning, though, Friday, employees did notice Ben's truck there. From what it sounds like, they noticed when they first opened, or, you know, like when the first employees arrived to open, but then they didn't see Ben anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So then they started talking to each other, comparing notes, and determined that no one had seen Ben since Wednesday evening. So that is when Eduardo called the police. What I find interesting is that according to a Tampa Bay Times article, the police immediately treated the area like a crime scene, even stringing up yellow crime scene tape.
That is curious. I wonder if it is dependent on what Eduardo said to them.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't have details of what exactly he told them. But yeah, apparently they just treated it like a crime scene right off the bat, which we don't usually hear about in cases like this.
Or maybe they were just assuming that, or not necessarily even assuming, but thinking that if he had drowned, they would want to preserve any evidence
right
away.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a kind of a common practice in that area.
Yeah. It very well may be. I don't know. They searched Ben's truck and inside found his wallet containing his driver's license, his diver's certifications, and about $1,000 in cash. They also found his cell phone and other personal items.
Yeah, I mean, things you wouldn't want to get wet.
Exactly, right? They eventually, you know, checked his cell phone, and the last call that was made was before the dive, and it was to his mother. More importantly, they also found his dive log in which he had mapped the cave. Holmes County Sheriff's Captain Harry Hamilton knew that Ben needed help. Cave diving first started to become a thing in the 80s and as such was largely unregulated.
Mm-hmm.
This led to a lot of deaths.
I can imagine.
Yeah. With 13 people dying at Vortex Springs alone during this decade. As the hobby became more regulated, deaths predictably went down. When Ben took his dive in 2010, only about a half dozen people worldwide died each year cave diving. The gate I mentioned earlier is about 300 feet from the mouth of the cave. As you get in deeper, it gets more treacherous with many narrow passages, some measuring just 10 inches from floor to ceiling.
Nope.
10 inches. So, like, imagine you're swimming and there's, like, a 10-inch high opening. Like, I feel like my head is, like, 10 inches. Like, I feel like there's no way a human could fit through there.
I mean, why would you even want to try?
I don't know. Like, I'm getting, like, I think my heart rate is up just thinking about it. But these areas are so narrow that the divers can't wear the tanks on their backs. They have to wear them on their sides. After the diving community began to find out about the missing diver, a recovery team was established and went down to find Ben. These were, of course, cave certified divers who were aware of the risks that they were facing. And they went down and immediately made a discovery. Are you ready to lose weight? With Effecty, getting access to powerful GLP-1 weight loss medications has never been easier or more affordable. Effecty offers compounded semaglutide, the same active ingredient as the popular name brands, but for up to 80% less. These medications work by regulating appetite and blood sugar, helping you lose weight in a sustainable, science-backed way. Getting started is so simple. Just fill out a short medical questionnaire, then connect with a licensed provider through a quick chat-based telehealth consultation. If you're eligible, your prescription gets shipped straight to your door. No hassle, no waiting rooms. With transparent pricing, no hidden fees, and no membership required, Effecty is committed to making proven weight loss treatments accessible to everyone. Effecty gave me the opportunity to try their service out, and I have to say, it is just as easy as they say it is. I filled out the questionnaire, and within days, a package arrived at my door filled with everything I needed and detailed instructions. Their website also tells you everything you need to know, and you can always chat with your healthcare provider. It really is that simple and convenient. So if you're ready to level up your weight loss game, my listeners can now get $50 off of GLP-1 weight loss treatments at Effecty.com with code ATTWG at checkout. That's Effecty.com, EFFECTY.com, and use the code ATTWG to get $50 off your first month of GLP-1 weight loss treatment. No hassles, no memberships, and No hidden fees. So get started today. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. They didn't find Ben, but they did find his decompression tanks. He would have needed these in order to safely resurface, so finding those and no diver around them was certainly disconcerting.
Yeah.
Diver after diver continued to venture into the cave, each one going deeper than the last. But they found nothing else. They searched until nearly midnight, but no Ben. Divers and the crowd were all flabbergasted. The recovery team had gone deep, deep into the crevices of the cave, but didn't find the missing diver. They couldn't believe that he had gotten further than they had already gone, but, I mean, he must have, because where else would he be?
Yeah, I mean, I guess. Nothing else makes sense.
No. I mean, there was no sign of him on land. All of his stuff was in his car. Nobody had seen him reemerge from the water. There were security cameras there, like around the dive shop. He wasn't on them. Everything pointed to Ben being in the water, and more specifically, in that cave.
Right. Why would he take his decompression tanks off? Maybe to fit somewhere smaller?
Yeah, apparently, and I might get this wrong, but I think I read somewhere that, like, you take multiple tanks and then, like, leave them in certain places so that you can, like, kind of grab them and, like, mark your way back almost.
Okay.
And then, like, grab them if you need them or when you need them, not if. So it might have been something along those lines.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right, so this next part comes directly from that Tampa Bay Times article that I mentioned, written by Ben Montgomery. Quote, "The mapped portion of the cave ends at a narrow restriction about 150 feet deep and 1,500 feet of mostly horizontal penetration, about the length of 5 football fields. The tiny hole, as small as 10 inches from floor to ceiling, is the last known restriction. Some divers say it's impassable. Some say you can get in, but you won't get out. On the official map, it simply says, exploration continues," end quote.
God, yes, it's claustrophobic.
Ugh. Local law enforcement broke the news to Ben's parents in Tennessee around 11 a.m. on Friday. They knew that there was no way Ben could have survived underwater for that long. They broke the terrible news to Ben's girlfriend, Emily, threw some clothes in the bag, and started the heartbreaking 7-hour drive down to Florida. Scuba shop owner and expert recovery diver Ed Sorensen was on vacation in the Bahamas when all of this was going on, so he hadn't heard about the missing diver. After recovery efforts on Saturday were also unsuccessful, his phone began to get bombarded with texts and calls, some from the divers who had already gone down. One said that he had almost died, while another told Ed that there was no way Ben could have gotten further into the cave than he went. Ed returned to Florida and decided to join the recovery effort. When he went down, he squeezed himself into impossible crevices, venturing 200 feet past the end of the map.
Jeez.
There, he saw marks on the cave walls that another rescuer had made in order to map his progress, to like show how far he had gotten.
Yeah.
Ed managed to make it another 20 feet after that. But there, he saw no markings, either from a rescuer or from Ben. Not only did he not see any markings or equipment or any indication that Ben had been down there, but if Ben were dead and wedged somewhere he couldn't see, there would have been increased activity from the scavengers.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, all the eels and, you know, and the different fish, but there was nothing. Ben was also an inch taller and 20 pounds heavier than Ed, and while that might not be a big difference on land, that's a huge difference when you're talking about squeezing into these tight spaces.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a 10-inch space.
Yeah.
20 pounds makes it,
I mean, that's
a huge difference.
A gigantic difference. It even said that, like, at one point, Ed couldn't get through like one of the crevices. He had to like turn his head sideways in order to make it through. If you're turning your head sideways instead of having it, you know, straight ahead, like 20 pounds is.
Yeah, that's definitely going to prevent you from getting into that same crevice.
Yeah, absolutely. Ed did 3 separate dives. And when he finished, he believed that there was no way that Ben had made it further than he did.
So this is a lake, though, right? This isn't like...
Well, yeah, it's like a spring, but yeah.
Yeah, it's not like the ocean where it goes on forever or whatever. So like...
Right.
Did they then... Did they look for him in other parts of the lake as well?
Yes. Yeah, so I'll get into more of the search. Because, yeah, they did start to fan out, obviously, you know, after all of these divers went down and couldn't find them. They're like, okay, well, maybe...
Maybe he made it out of the cave.
Right. But something else happened.
Something happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Because so after, you know, all these people went down, after Ed did his 3 dives, the basic consensus of the divers is that Ben was not down there. Nevertheless, they kept searching. Rescuers organized dives for 36 consecutive days.
Whoa.
But they found no further evidence of Ben. The McDaniels, however, were convinced that Ben was still down in that cave somewhere. Searches continued into November, with the McDaniels becoming more frustrated as divers failed to find their son. The following April, the McDaniels offered a $10,000 reward to entice new searchers. Ben's dad, Shelby, said, quote, "We are offering the $10,000 because there's someone somewhere in this world who is brave enough to go back there and find Ben," end quote.
Or find a watery grave, find their own.
Exactly. That is the point that divers were making. So this statement and the reward, it was a big point of contention in the diving community because they saw it and the statement as a dig on the many divers who had already risked their lives to find their son's remains. They were also fearful that it would tempt the wrong person who would go down there in hopes of getting the money and not make it back up.
Right.
Nevertheless, the reward was eventually raised to $30,000. In 2012, a diver named Larry Higginbottom died in the cave at Vortex Springs. There was no definitive proof that he was diving in hopes of collecting the reward, but many people strongly suspected that that was the case. Cadaver dogs were brought in by the sheriff's department. One reacted strongly to the surface of the water, indicating that there was human decomposition. One reacted less strongly, indicating that there was a possibility of human decomposition. However, someone from the health department came in and tested the water in 30 different places. He found no evidence of bacteria that would indicate the presence of decomposition. Hmm. Now, kind of what you were getting at before with, you know, were they looking in other areas of the water? Yes, the possibility of Ben dying outside of the cave and getting swept away was also investigated. Tracking dogs were used and searches downstream were performed, but nothing was found. Huh. With divers pretty much universally convinced that Ben wasn't in the water, investigators started to look at other options because there was definitely some weirdness about this entire situation, not the least of which, of course, being the fact that they can't find Ben. So remember those decompression tanks that they found?
Yeah.
It turns out that they were filled with regular air.
Hmm.
Not the special mix of gases that would have been needed for cave diving. Even though Ben, again, wasn't certified as a cave diver, he had done enough research that he would have known what he needed to take down with him.
Sure.
And then also, because it does seem as though he had been down in the caves before, so he obviously would have...
Yeah, he had to have known what to put in the decompression tanks.
Exactly. And that also seems like a mistake you only make once, right? Like if you put the wrong air in and you somehow survive, you don't do that a second time.
Yeah.
And you certainly don't put the right mix of air, of gases in the tanks for some dives. And then, you know, on a later dive go, oh, I'll just fill these ones with air. Like,
yeah,
that's not what you do. So they didn't really know what that meant. But it was definitely strange.
Mm-hmm.
And they do know they were his tanks. They literally had his name on them. Then there was the fact that Ben's truck wasn't noticed for 2 days. Yes, it was busy, like I said, but his truck was parked in a visible spot. Plus, you know, like it was discovered presumably when the employees first got there, you know, in the morning on Friday. So what about the employees?
They didn't notice it on Thursday?
Yeah. And nobody, or maybe they did.
But nobody said anything.
Yeah, nobody clocked it as weird,
yeah.
Which, okay, fine. Maybe you're thinking that he was getting an early start or whatever, and, you know, not a big deal because he was there all the time. But would they have noticed that it was still there when they were closing?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Plus, there was the fact that Chuck and Eduardo usually stuck around to make sure that Ben made it up safely, but on that particular night, they decided to go back to Eduardo's house for coffee.
For coffee?
Yeah, which is just like a weird detail. I don't know. But either way, it does seem strange that that was the night that they chose to just take off.
Yeah, I'm not 100% on their version of the story.
Right. Well, and neither were investigators. So they actually asked them to take polygraphs. And they agreed. And they both passed.
Remind me again, was there security footage of their interaction and like Ben going into the water?
I don't think so, because I think the security footage was like more around the dive shop.
Okay.
So I don't think the cameras like were around the water. But I believe, you know, it covered at least like part of the parking lot, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure it showed them leaving. You know, I don't know about that specifically, but I do know that Ben was never seen leaving, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
The dive shop owner, Lowell Kelly, told investigators that a wild-eyed man had come by on that Wednesday and asked if it was too late to dive. He gave this information to investigators with the thought that maybe this man had something to do with it. Like maybe he abducted Ben.
Okay.
But Ben, according to Chuck and Eduardo, you know, would have been in all of his dive gear, which wasn't found.
Right.
And he was a pretty big dude. Again, 6'1", 210 pounds. So like, how do you abduct a big guy in like all of this dive gear without any sign of a struggle?
Right.
And why?
Yes, right. Why?
You know? And
what does a wild-eyed guy mean? What, that is a...
sound wild eyes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, Lowell was kind of a character from what it sounds like. And we'll talk about him more in a minute here. But also, you know, along with the like random abduction or like whatever theory, Ben's truck was left behind and he had like $1,000 worth of cash. And if I'm just a random criminal with no ties to Ben or to anybody, I feel like I would try the truck first, you know, if I'm like trying to steal something or whatever. And, you know, nobody tried to break in or take anything. So why would you go straight to like trying to abduct a grown man?
I don't know. I mean, people do wild stuff.
I mean, it's true, especially if you have wild eyes, I guess. But, you know, they kind of obviously discarded that theory. And then, you know, as time went on, more and more theories, like maybe it wasn't this random stranger. Maybe it was somebody in Ben's life, like his ex-business partner. Like maybe he came down to Florida and did something. But like nobody really thought, I mean, that I don't have a lot of details about their partnership and how it went bad and all of that, but it just seemed a little too outside of anything. Like, why would he do it? It was over, you know?
Yeah.
Investigators also, of course, considered the possibility that Ben staged his death and went off to start a new life.
Yeah, I mean, that's not outside of the realm of possibilities.
No, absolutely not. After all, he had a lot of issues. No job, tax debt, a failed business, no home of his own. On the surface, he seemed like the type of person who would want to just run away and start over and escape his problems. But those closest to him didn't believe that Ben could do that to his parents. He saw what Paul's death did to them, and no one who knew Ben believed that he would willingly inflict that pain on his parents. Plus, Ben was in a good place when he disappeared. Like, yeah, it had been rough for him, but his relationship with Emily was going well, and he was planning for the future. Then there was Spooner, his dog. When police went to Ben's house on Friday, the day he was reported missing, Spooner was there, hungry after not being fed for 2 days.
Oh, Spooner.
I know. Like, would he have left his dog to suffer like that?
Yeah, no way.
Yeah, so it didn't make sense. Although that theory, honestly, is one that's still out there. And especially when you go back to those dive tanks, you know, the fact that they were just filled with regular air kind of leads people to believe that they were staged there.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that, but I don't know. The dog bothers me. Like, obviously, anybody that has a dog is very close with their animal. And like, if you're going to like run off and start a new life, you can still take the dog.
Right. Or at least just make sure that he's safe
he's taken care of.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't just leave him in your house, like locked up with no food.
Yeah.
But the McDaniels did, though, briefly consider this, right? Like maybe he did run away. Maybe he had some sort of like psychotic break and just like compulsively ran off. But they eventually discarded this and did start to consider foul play. They hired a private investigator, Lynn Marie Carty, to look into the people associated with Ben and with Vortex Springs. And as it turned out, several people had criminal records.
What level of criminal records, though?
Well, so I don't know specifically about most of them. Who we do know about is Vortex Springs owner, Lowell Kelly. At the time of Ben's disappearance, he was in a little bit of hot water.
Okay.
He had allegedly taken a temporary employee who, one story said that the guy owed Lowell thousands of dollars. Another story that I read said that Lowell accused this man of stealing like $30,000. But either way, he believed that this man owed him money. So he took him out to the woods, like near an alligator pond, apparently, and attempted to beat him with a baseball bat to make him pay up.
Jesus.
Yeah. The man fortunately escaped and went to the police. Kelly was charged with assault and kidnapping. He was eventually convicted of aggravated assault and sentenced to 7 years probation. The man he attacked was so freaked out that he moved his family out of the area and swore he'd never return.
So what does this have to do with Ben?
Well, it proves that this guy who owns the dive shop, you know, where Ben disappeared, it has a violent history.
Sure.
And, you know, the thought is that maybe he got into an argument with Ben or something along those lines, and he did something to Ben and hit his body. And either Chuck and Eduardo were helping him cover it up by coming up with this like evening dive story, or it happened after the dive. And, you know, Chuck and Eduardo passed the polygraph because, as far as they knew, they were telling the truth. Ben never came back up. And, you know, something happened between Lowell Kelly and him afterwards. But in terms of like a motive that Kelly would have had, I mean, nothing was ever uncovered.
Yeah, it's not like Ben has any money.
Yeah, but then also, why? I mean, $1,000 is a lot of cash.
Well, his parents are rich.
His parents are rich. But yeah, I would be interested. I never read anything that said if Ben was the type of person who carried a lot of cash with him,
mm-hmm.
right? If that was a normal occurrence, because to me, like, it would be absurd to have $1,000 in my wallet unless I was like going somewhere that I needed to pay $1,000 in cash for a particular reason, you know?
Right.
So I don't know if that's the type of person he was, or if perhaps there was a particular reason that day he had $1,000 in cash on him. And could whatever that reason have something to do with his disappearance?
Mm-hmm.
In March 2012, about 19 months after their son went missing, the McDaniels brought in a second round of cadaver dogs. And part of the reason that they did this was to look for clues that would have potentially pointed to Lowell Kelly having had something to do with Ben's disappearance. They didn't find anything, but even if they had, Kelly wouldn't have faced any charges because by this time he was dead. And he also died under mysterious circumstances.
Okay.
In December 2011, there was a party at Vortex Springs. Kelly was reportedly drinking moonshine and got pretty drunk, as you can imagine, and a friend helped him home. Now, during the journey home, Kelly fell and hit his head. The friend got him home and left him in the bathtub overnight. One story I read said that he covered him with a blanket in the bathtub and left. I don't know why the bathtub and not the bed or the couch or even the floor.
I guess maybe in case he threw up, he could clean it up easier.
Yes.
I don't know.
But he was left in the bathtub. Then a different friend went to his house the next morning, I guess to check on him, and saw that Kelly was still in the bathtub, but was unresponsive. He called 911 and paramedics rushed him to the hospital. Lowell Kelly never regained consciousness and died several days later. Police investigated the death, but as far as I can tell, no determination of foul play or anything else was ever made. The PI, Lynn Marie Carty, was frustrated that the sheriff's department wasn't looking too hard into the possibility of Ben being the victim of a homicide, saying that there was just as much reason to look for Ben above ground as there was to look for him in the water. It's so weird, right? Like, it doesn't sound like there's any way Ben could be in that cave.
No, not with the level of divers that have gone down and explored farther than anyone ever had before.
Yeah. And, you know, even Eduardo, he talked about how for how long afterwards on his Wednesday dives, like, he would go and look for Ben, you know, like, not to get the reward or anything, but just because it bothered him.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, nobody ever found anything else other than those decompression tanks.
So then you think, okay, if he's not there and, you know, he's not in another part of the lake because they explored that already.
Yeah.
Then.
And the shore and, you know.
Yeah. So then he gets out of the water, something happens, but there's no there's no evidence that anything happened on land either.
Right. Because no sign of a struggle.
They looked.
Like there's no blood anywhere.
Right.
You know, none of his equipment, his wetsuit, you know, goggles, like nothing.
Right. So what does that leave us with?
I don't know. Let's go back to the, he faked his death. Why leave $1,000 in cash?
Right. Unless, well, yeah, I don't know. That doesn't make any sense.
Right. Because, you know, okay, maybe it would be suspicious if he left an empty wallet, but maybe leave $100 in there or something. Right. You know what I mean? Like $1,000 is a lot to leave behind.
Right.
I don't know the exact coverage of the security cameras at the dive shop, but, you know, he wasn't seen on them. And would he have known enough about the coverage of the security cameras to avoid them?
Right. Yeah.
Like, maybe. I don't know.
It's hard to say.
And, you know, of course, as the days and weeks and months and, you know, everything went on, police kept an eye on his bank accounts and his Facebook profile and, you know, all of the normal stuff. And there was never any activity. And not only that, but there have never been any reported sightings of him.
Hmm.
Like, not even false ones, you know? Just nothing.
Right, which we did get in Hoagie's case. Robert Hoagland.
Yep. Yeah, there were reported sightings.
Yeah. So then it goes back to foul play, to murder.
Right.
But again, there's no...
There's no evidence. And so one theory that I didn't even really talk about in the episode because it doesn't make any sense is that Ben did drown in the cave or, you know, in the water or like whatever, right? And the dive shop employees or, you know, Lowell Kelly, like whoever, somebody associated with the dive shop, took his body out of the water and did something with it in order to avoid liability. But like,
I mean, it's
that doesn't, I mean, I don't, it doesn't make any sense because, you know, they admitted that they unlocked the gate for him.
Right.
They admitted that they knew he had been going down there and he wasn't certified. Like they're admitting all sorts of
things that could open them up to a wrongful death lawsuit.
Right.
Yes. Right.
And so, it, like, so that doesn't make any sense that they would just like, oh shit, somebody had an accident. Like, let's go hide the body. Because again, that happens. And it happened in 2012 with Larry Higginbottom. He died in that cave and he was found because, you know, he didn't show up to wherever he was supposed to show up to. Mm-hmm. They went down the next day. They found him and called all the proper authorities and, you know, did whatever.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that theory is debunked.
Right? Yeah. So that's why I didn't even like put it in the episode.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's like, okay, well maybe he was murdered and then fed to the alligators.
Sure. But where was he murdered and how?
And
how,
why and by whom? And
how is there no
evidence?
Trace evidence.
Yeah. Right. And again, he had all of his equipment, everything.
Right. Where is all that?
Yeah.
Alligators don't eat metal air tanks.
Right. You would think that they would have disposed of it, but like it just, all of it just seems like there isn't a single answer that I feel like makes sense.
Yeah, I'm stumped by this one.
Yeah. It's just so spooky just because of the cave diving in general.
Yeah.
Which is spooky as hell.
Yeah.
Under the best of circumstances. And then to have no, just nothing makes sense.
He's just gone.
Yeah. The McDaniels are tortured by unanswered questions. Though their younger son Paul's death was horribly tragic, some good came out of it. They were able to donate his organs. They even had the opportunity to meet the man who received their son's heart and listen to it beat once more through a stethoscope. With Ben, they just have a suitcase that family and friends filled with notes and mementos that they buried near Paul. Taryn was at Vortex Springs in 2012 when the McDaniels were down there with the cadaver dogs. Shelby, Ben's dad, gave him a small granite slab that they had made up. It said, Ben McDaniel, 1980 to 2010, beloved son and brother. He gave it to Taran, who said he would find a nice place down in the cave to place it. 3 years after Ben's last dive at Vortex Springs, he was legally declared dead. Shelby McDaniel went on to a forum on scubaboard.com about Ben in order to give the divers who had been following Ben's story, some of whom assisted in the recovery efforts, an update. He said, quote, "This upcoming August 18th, he will have been missing 3 years. We miss him. All his furniture and clothes are as it was the day he left to dive at Vortex Springs. I drive his truck now. Of course, his dog Spooner lives with us, as does Paul's dog Emma. We have Paul's bedroom suite as it was when he died of a stroke, September 14th, 2008. We miss him too, and Paul lives on as he gave the gift of life to 4 people and his tissue to help others live a better life. His heart recipient comes to see us every year from Dallas." End quote. As of this recording, in December 2023, no further evidence of Ben McDaniel has been found. Ben McDaniel has been missing from Ponce de Leon, Florida, since August 18, 2010. He is a white male with brown hair and blue eyes. He was 6'1" and approximately 210 pounds at the time of his disappearance. He was last seen wearing a black wetsuit, C-130 scuba tanks, goggles, yellow fins, a computer dive watch, and possibly small round earrings. He was 30 when he went missing. He would be 43 today. Anyone with information on the disappearance of Ben McDaniel is urged to call the Holmes County Sheriff's Office at 850-547-3681. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!